I'd like to introduce our speaker for today, who will speak until 10:10, and then we'll answer questions from the audience. Let's all welcome Garth from Santa Ana.
My homeboy's back there. My name's Garth, alcoholic. My sobriety day is 7/14/08. For that, I'm grateful. Unbelievable deal. I brought notes because I'm not very good at this. For me to be standing in front of you guys talking right now is nothing short of a miracle. We're talking about, full-blown alcoholic. I never was much of a drug addict. I like the booze. I'll take booze over anything. Jails, prisons, hospitals, the whole thing. I do remember my first drink because it was Bacardi 151, and she gave me this little cup. This girl, she gave me this little cup, like a Dixie cup, and I'm like, well, can I get a bigger cup, you know? Give me a little bit more, you know, and I got so sick, and you know, the usual puking all over the parents' house and stuff like that, and I'll never forget that. And you know, all the as I speak, my entire story, there's alcohol present. Of, you know, no matter what I did, there was alcohol there. I had the kind of guy that had to drink before I did anything. I had to drink before I drank, so I could drink. You know, one of my biggest fears was, what do you mean I can't drink? Okay, Alcoholics Anonymous, cool. You know, that's great. You guys are very nice people. But what am I going to do, you know, when I can't? What do you mean I can't drink? Not at all? You know what I mean? And because I drank, that's what I did. I drank. The music business, there are people that know what that's like, and the music business is, and I don't blame anything, it's all me, but the music business is permeated with drugs and alcohol, and I play the drums. I've always played since I was a little kid, playing in clubs since I was 17, and drugs and alcohol all over the place, all the time, a big party till you drop scene, and I was in with both feet, and count me in. Whatever you got, you know, and I grew up in the mean streets of Tustin Meadows. I don't know if anybody knows it. No houses under 800,000 there. I just running around over there, and I was the first punk rocker in Tustin, California, with a Liberty Spikes mohawk, and this is documented fact. You can call it in. We used to get in fights all the time, just because that was when the California, or the United States punk rock scene, or at least the California punk rock scene, and Orange County was kind of the start of it all. First introduced to people, and people didn't know what to think and stuff like that. We were just little crazy punk rockers running around, causing trouble. And I'd never forget one time I'm coming home and I'm drunk, walking across Red Hill to jump into Tustin Meadows parallels Red Hill right there. And I was coming from Alpha Beta, and I was going to hop the wall to go into my mom's, my parents' house. And I get up on the wall, and Tustin cops come, and they think I'm probably breaking my mohawk, you know what I mean? And probably think I'm breaking in there, and they stop, freeze, and I wobbled on top of the wall, fell face first down onto the ground, broke my nose in two places, and just wasted. And so now I'm bleeding all over. I got blood everywhere. The cops are trying to get over the wall, so I run in front to knock on my parents' door. It's 3 a.m. I'm like, you know, knocking on the door. They finally come to the door. There I'm standing, blood everywhere, and cops are like, freeze, freeze, get on the ground. Hi, Mom. And back then, you know, that kind of stuff, they just let my parents take control of me, and they didn't arrest me and stuff like that. But back in the day, that was The Tustin cops really had nothing better to do than to do stuff like that, and they were cool and they let me go. But I got kicked out of every school in the district in Tustin. Every school, they wouldn't let me go to school here. I went to Tustin High for about 2 weeks, and I got kicked out of there. Got kicked out of what's the one right over here? No, I did. I actually graduated from Hillview. They let me graduate. Those guys are great. Half that school was loaded, I swear to God. They kicked me out of all the schools. They shipped me to Cyprus. So, and this lady from the SAR board, the Scholastic Aptitude Review Board, actually lived in right down the street from here. And my mom would drop me off at her house, and she would take me to school in Cyprus. And I go to school in Cyprus, and I still have the mohawk. And just think mohawk. And I get to that school, and it's all gangsters. And they're like, you know, who's this vato? You know what I mean? But they left me alone because they figured this guy must be crazy because he's got a mohawk and he's coming to this school, you know. So they were like scared of me, I guess. But I get along okay over there. And then I finally went back to Hillview and got my my GED. And this whole time just drinking and crazy, you know. It's scary when I think back at how early I was drinking alcoholically. I mean, it was right from the get-go I was drinking alcoholically. My friends, it was drink as much as you can until you puke or pass out. You know, that was the goal of each night. You know, I remember that stuff and all the Cuckoo's Nest and stuff like that, and all those little punk rock clubs and stuff like that. It was drink until you fall down. And that was at 16 years old, 15 years old. So, needless to say, you know, I qualify as an alcoholic. And it wasn't until I got to the program that I realized how alcoholic I really was. And started to get into, you know, pot and stuff like that. I was selling pot for a while, and that was great. So I didn't have to work. All the pot you can smoke, and I'm not even a pot smoker, and you know, I smoked it anyway, you know. So I'm at the Key Inn. It used to be the Sixpence Inn. Everybody remembers that, right? Great place. It was the Sixpence Inn, and I'm in the hotel room with my girlfriend, and I'm weighing out all this pot, and I'm getting it ready to, you know, be sold and stuff like that. And Red's looking at me like, oh, man. Yeah, yeah. And I getting bagging this stuff up, and then finally, the guy that said that he was going to come back for it didn't come back for it, so now I have it, and it's checkout time, and I don't have any more money. And so I check out, throw it in my friend's truck, throw it in the back of the truck. The cab was full, so I had to get right in the back of the truck, the pickup truck, and get pulled over by undercover cops. And they're like, whose is this? I'm like, well, it's not mine, you know. Why, you know, it's not my weed. They're like, well, it's sitting right next to you. I know. It's your weed. I don't know. So at this point, I get arrested with a scale, with the weed, and various other things. And my mom and my dad get me I think I was 20. I was, 22 or something, like whatever. But my mom and dad get me a lawyer, $5,000 for this lawyer, and she gets me off with probation and 2 year suspended sentence hanging over my head. And I'm like, great, I'm going to be good from now on. You know, I'm 22 years old. I'm going to be good. I don't want to go to prison, you know. And about a month and a half later, I'm in prison going, what happened? You know what I mean? And So I'm 20. I think I was 23 in my first doing my first prison term, and just scared. I was just scared, and you know, and I'm walking in the yard to go into chow or something like that. There's three of my friends that I know from growing up, but I hadn't seen in a long time. Three of my friends are in prison, and I'm looking, you know, thinking to myself, this is great. You know what I mean? This is not a good place to meet your old friends. You know what I mean? And so I do that little prison term, and I get out of prison. And I actually stayed good, and I didn't do anything for 13 months, got kicked loose from parole. And, you know, I wasn't, because I didn't have any alcohol charges, so I could drink all I wanted. As a matter of fact, one of those parole officers was like, I don't care how much you drink. Just don't do any drugs and don't smoke any weed. And I'm like, oh, okay, I can do that. I'm not a drug addict anyway, right? So I took that ball and ran with it. You know, it's like, okay, I can drink all I want. Okay, so that's all I did. And I think that's when the disease really got a hold of me, is when that parole officer said that. It was almost like giving me a green light. And then it really got its claws into me. I was good for a while, didn't do any drugs or anything like that, no dirty tests. Got off in 13 months and was good, you know, doing my thing for another year out there. And I'm 25 or 26, and I decided, well, since I'm not on parole anymore, right, I can grow a little pot, right? And all this time, I'm not a pot smoker. I'm really not. I don't even like pot. It's just that's part of my story, you know what I mean? And I feel weird talking about it. But so I figured, okay, I can grow a little bit of pot. And so I got, you know, a few five plants, and they come by, Riverside Police bashing the door, and there I am again, arrested. They can, you know, there's nothing I can do. This is mine. This is my weed. You know, they know it's my weed. It's in my apartment. You know, I can't get out of this one. And so I'm thinking I'm in jail, and I'm thinking I'm just going to get a little 30 days or something like that. And they come at me with 16 months. So I'm back in prison my second time. And I'm like, this, I'm seeing a pattern here, you know? And this one was Calipatria, which is the southernmost prison in California. And it was all level 4, and I was scared shitless. I was like, I could not believe that I was here, and these guys were doing, there's lifers here, these guys were doing all day. You know, I, mommy, you know what I mean? I should not. You got to get me out of here. Yeah, you got to do something. I don't belong here. You got to get me out of here. And so I went to that little support yard. I went through the 4 yards, and then you end up on the support yard, which is little level. I was just a little old level 1, just had little, you know, 16 points or something like that. But so I did that, and I got a job as a printer, making blueprints. And I had that job for 10 years. The entire time I'm working at this place, I'm drinking at work, before work, well, first all night, before work, just to get me through to my little lunch break, and have like a half pint or so, maybe more, on my lunch break. And then every couple hours, I got to go have a cigarette, right? So I go out to my car and have a few shots of vodka. Nothing like 100 degrees outside, and you got your vodka bottle in the back seat of your car. So the vodka bottle is like 110 degrees, maybe. Taking a shot of that, baby, that's living right there. That's living. And it's like, I think about it now and it gags me. It's like, and I would drink that stuff, you know what I mean? Or, you know, or it's in a water bottle, or I would put Jack Daniels in a water bottle so it looked like tea, or put it in a tea bottle. Tea Java. Tea Java looks just like Jack Daniels. Tea. And Yeah, I drank Jack Daniels for a long time, and then when it got really bad, I started with the vodka, of course, because you can't smell vodka, right? Someone told me differently, and I was like, really? You don't smell that? And that, yeah, it smells like friggin' alcohol. I don't know why we all end up with vodka. I did. I ended up with vodka at the end, and that's just how it goes. And, you know, I would have to drink every couple hours, or I would start to detox. And when I detox, I have seizures. I've had 3 seizures due to alcohol abuse. And one of them, the first one I had was really, really bad. I ended up in ICU for, I think, 6 days or something. I contracted pneumonia when I was in the hospital for it. And that was a bad one. And you would think, you know, that you would learn something from that. But it was like something happened with my feet. I couldn't feel my feet. And the feeling didn't come back in my feet for like almost 3 weeks. And I was bedridden for like 3 weeks. And that didn't stop me. You know what I mean? And once I got better, once I got feeling a little bit better, started drinking again. And this whole time, I'm keeping this job. I'm holding this job down, which really kind of amazed me how I did that. I don't know how I did that, but I did. And for 10 years, I had that job. And somewhere in there, I did another prison term. Went to Wasco for another 2-year term for, it was possession of controlled substance. I had somebody's speed. It was somebody else's speed, you know. And during that time, during that little prison time, I woke up one day in there, and I'm in Wasco State Prison. This is out by Bakersfield, I guess. I don't know where Rosedale or Oildale or whatever the hell it is out there. People out there have accents. I don't know. They're from California, but they have accents. I'm like, really? One of those days in there, I woke up in there, and I was comfortable. You know, when I was comfortable, I had a host of friends. I had a locker full of food and coffee and cigarettes and everything I could possibly want in life was there for me in prison. And I was happy. And that scared the crap out of me. I was content to be in prison, and I thought that was going to be my lot in life for the rest of my life. I was in some acceptance, and that scared me. And from that, I'll never forget that day, because from that day on, I vowed that this is going to be my last time doing this. It wasn't my last time getting loaded or drinking, but it was my last time in prison, and it worked. And I hated every second of it after that day. But so this last time, the last time I was in jail, I'm going to get to the experience, strength and hope part. I got into it with some deputies. This is 2008. 10 minutes. Okay. It's 2008. I'm in jail for some Vicodins that weren't mine. And I got a felony of controlled substance, you know, and they look at my record, they throw me in jail, and I'm in jail, and I get into it with these deputies, and they pick me up off the ground and slam me down on the concrete, and I landed on my right hip, fracturing my pelvic bone, and that blow knocked me out, so I didn't notice the kicks, so I had like 3 broken ribs also, and woke up in a cell by myself, screaming my head off involuntarily because of the pain. The whole side of my right body, the whole right side of my body was red, like a bruised red, like blood. They took me to emergency surgery, and I got a bunch of steel in my leg. And to this day, I limp to this day. And that's what got me. That's what got my attention finally. It got me into some surrender. And I just said, dear God, I give up. What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? I got to Charlie Street and got through the detox and went to a sober living house, a recovery house, actually, which is a difference. And and I've been sober ever since. I now am the secretary, the committee secretary at that same detox. And I volunteer my time there all the time. I'm on a committee. I do their paperwork. I see everybody that comes and goes through that place. And I'm surprised each week at how many people I know that are coming back through there for the second time, the third time. And it's just unbelievable. And this disease is, you know, this disease won't kill me. I mean, it'll keep me alive for a good long time in complete and utter misery. It's not the death part that scares me about alcoholism. It's the life part, living in that misery. And I look back and you know, my life, I run the recovery house now, and I'm just blessed to be able to do that and to see I've got guys here that are changing their lives and getting time in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's how I get paid, is to watch these guys change their lives. You know, from I've seen just down and out convicts institutionalized completely to getting their life back, getting their kids back in their life, becoming productive parts of society. And I watch that stuff and I'm amazed every day. And it's just like, it's so great, you know. That is the payment. And if it wasn't for this program and you people, I'd be one of those guys with the 30-pound liver, homeless, you know, asking for money for booze. And that's where my alcoholism would take me. I know this. So it's you know, it is an option. Drinking is an option, but it's not something that I think about with any, you know, I don't think about drinking. Once in a while, because I'm a human being and I'm an alcoholic, I do think about drinking, but it's not, it's just a fleeting thought, you know. I had 4.5 years sober, and I've been blessed with some of the best guys, some of the best, my Tuesday night meeting, these guys are all solid, and I'm just humbled to be a part of that group. I'm humbled to be a part of Charlie Street. I'm humbled to be running that recovery house, and it's all because of you guys. And I just can't say enough about Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's changed my life, and so that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So my little bit short. Quit smoking. I looked at my notes. I just quit smoking. Yeah. I used the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to quit smoking. And I got the little e-cigarette still, but I'm weaning myself off that. But I smoked for 25 years. That was the hardest thing I've ever done, is quit smoking. And I smoked a pack a day or more. And that was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. And I owe it all to you guys and to God and to Alcoholics Anonymous. How I feel is, to me, this thing is an inside job. How I feel inside is night and day from the way I felt when I got here. I was void of any spirituality when I got here. I was just kind of like a shell. And, you know, it's just night and day. And my life hasn't changed as far as shiny things go and stuff like that, but I've realized how little I really need in life. And, you know, I'm just happy to be here. Just happy to be here and to be sober. I can be a part of my parents' life now, who are getting on in age. And my mom doesn't drive anymore, so I drive her around and stuff like that, wherever she needs to go. My dad is a faller. He falls. He falls. Like, Dad, what are you doing? And he was in the hospice, not hospice, but what is it, assisted living for a while. And I was able to go over there for a while and see him and be present and be helpful in any way I can. And my parents call me, I'm there. At any time of the day, any time of the night, I'm there. And same thing for any other alcoholic that calls me, I'm there. So thanks for letting me share, you guys.
Okay, so I'm going to turn the meeting back over to Garth for a question and answer period.
This is the fun part?
Yeah.
What am I supposed to do? Ask if there's any questions? With the 12 steps. Oh, I got a... when I got here, first of all, for the, two times before this, I went through Charlie Street three times. I do things in threes, prison terms, Charlie Street, seizures, till I finally get it through my head. I got here, I dabbled the first two times I was here. I dabbled in the steps and I looked at them and, you know, I said, all right, you know, so I go 1, 2, 3 out. You know, I've always believed in a God, so that wasn't never an issue. But, you know, all that inventory stuff, it was like, you know, who needs that? You know what I mean? And so 1, 2, 3 out, 1, 2, 3 out. And I got here the third time, busted up like I was talking about, and I couldn't walk. And I was so desperate and just dejected. That I couldn't, you know, I was out of ideas, out of stuff to you know, out of any plans. And I asked my sponsor, I got a sponsor that I knew already because he used to work at my work and I saw him there and he had 7 years or something like that. I said, bro, you have to help me. You know, I mean, you don't have any choice. You have to help me. And he did. And that man took me through the red nose him, took me through the steps, you know, one by one from the book, in order, thoroughly, and got me into action early. You know, got me into action at Charlie Street, got me into action at meetings, getting commitments at every meeting I went to. I had a commitment. I still do have commitments at 75% of the meetings that I go to, I have a commitment at, and that's because that's what I was told to do in the beginning. And the steps... the 12 steps transformed my life. If it wasn't for the steps, I wouldn't be here. Admitting I was an alcoholic, not a problem. I mean, there was ample evidence of that, you know. I have something that reminds me I'm an alcoholic every second of every day, and it's really painful. I have to get another surgery. That's a whole other story, but it's super painful, and it reminds me every day of what an alcoholic I am. And my experience with the steps is once I did those steps in order with a sponsor to the best of my ability, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink. And it was 4.5 years ago. My experience with the steps. Take them.
Thanks for your share.
Thank you. That was a tough one. I got out with some issues about that. I got out with resentments, of course. You know, I wasn't like, oh, it's not a big deal. You know what I mean? It altered my life. It changed my, it was a life-changing event. I got out and went to my doctor and said, look at me, you know, what is this? What did they do? You know, because I didn't even see any x-rays when I was in jail. Because I had another 4 months to do when I was laid up with this, with staples in and stitches. And I got out of jail and I went to my doctor. He gave me some pain pills. I was taking those and they weren't doing anything. So what works really good is vodka on top of the pain pills. That works. I don't remember anything for 10 days until I got to Charlie Street. But as far as turning it over, kind of. I spoke to, that was a tough one. I spoke to some lawyers, and two of them said, you don't have any recourse, really. You know, I mean, all they're going to say is you fought, you know, and I really didn't fight, but that's not the point. The point is, I put myself in that position to be in jail in the first place. This wouldn't have happened if I wasn't effing off and going to jail. And so I'm really to blame for it. My part in it is my part in it. And I turned that, I gave that up to God, because I can't afford to walk around with a resentment like that. You know, I cannot afford it. I'm an alcoholic. I'll drink over it. But it wasn't like right away. I turned that over in my head for a good long couple months. You know, I would tell people, I turned it over to God. But really, in my head, it was just festering. And when I actually did turn that over, I mean, through constant prayer. For, you know, however long it took, I don't know how long it took, but it was constant prayer about that. I need to turn this over and help me, and begging God for help with that. Once I did turn it over, it was, again, like a weight was lifted off my shoulders. It was very freeing, you know. When I took my third step, it was like some guy said, I don't remember who it was one of the guys in a meeting I was at said, dude, you can stop fighting now. And I was like, what do you mean? I'm not fighting anything, you know? And and then I thought about that, and I thought back on my life, and it's like, I've been fighting everyone and everything that's ever been good for me my entire life. Just fighting it, you know? Just fighting the man and just being, you know, a complete rebel for no reason. And, so when that statement, and again, I don't remember who it was. It might have been Gary, but he told me I could stop fighting, and that was the turning point, and that's when I realized I could do this thing. Thank you.